Hello everyone and welcome to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Today is part of an occasional look at the scientific talent produced by individual counties up and down Ireland. We're going to profile three County Offaly scientists. In the next half hour we'll be looking at the lives of Burcastle-born William Parsons and his son Charles, famous respectively for building the world's largest telescope and the invention of the steam turbine. We'll also be looking at John Joly, born in the village of Brackna, who became famous for many things, including investigations into the age of the earth, colour photography and the development of radiotherapy to treat cancer. All three men lived most of their lives in 19th century Ireland. Indeed, William Parsons lived all of his life in that century and would be considered Anglo-Irish Victorian scientists. This background perhaps meant that their names were somewhat forgotten, deliberately or not, following Irish independence in 1922, and it's only really in recent decades that their achievements and legacy is again being celebrated fully here in Ireland. In the first of three recorded interviews that you'll be hearing, I'll be talking first to John Joyce, retired scientist and tour guide at the Burcastle Science Centre, about the life of William Parsons, or the 3rd Earl of Ross, who built the world's largest telescope for more than 70 years in the middle of a great famine. Next, you'll hear an interview with TCD geologist Patrick Wise-Jackson, who's done detailed research on the life of John Joly. And lastly, we'll be back to John Joyce, this time to discuss the steam turbine inventor Charles Parsons. But first up, it's William Parsons, the 3rd Earl of Ross.
And I'm going to talk today about the Earl of Ross with John Joyce, who's a tour guide down there at Burr. So welcome to the program, John.
Thanks, Hugh. Thank you indeed.
Now, for the listeners that may not be familiar with this man, when did he live, first of all?
From 1800 to 1867. He died in 1867, late 1867.
Okay. Now, he did become very famous as an astronomer, but before we get into that, what kind of background was he born into? What was his family like?
Well, a very privileged background. His family had been landowners in Burr since the 1620s. They had grown in wealth and status over the next couple of hundred years. And were created baronets in 1675, so that gave them a status in the county, and often represented King's County as it then was in Parliament.
Okay, but, so it was quite a privileged background, and I suppose, unlike a lot of us today, you didn't have to go out and work 9 to 5 to earn a living, maybe?
No, indeed, although he took life very seriously. Mm-hmm. He was well educated, and the real key to his achievements is his education here in Burr. Now, unusually for the family, the boys in the 19th century were kept at home for their primary and second level education, so to speak. They had private tutors, whereas in previous generations they had been sent to English public schools.
Sure. So they were very much part of the Irish setup, the local setup down there. And so did he show an aptitude from an early age for astronomy or science?
Well, as far as I'm aware, the first real interest, I suppose, came when, because in 1807, his father had, the second Earl, had inherited the Earldom of Ross. And that meant that he, was a representative Irish peer, and that meant that he would have sat in the House of Lords in London. And that meant the family travelled to London regularly. And of course, in those days, travelling into London from Ireland on the stagecoach, you would have passed the village of Slough, where the greatest telescope was up to then, mm-hmm. Sir William Herschel's telescope.
Yes, and even today we have the Herschel telescope, don't we, after him.
Well, it's named after it, yes, but the original Herschel telescope was dismantled in the 1930s, I think.
So this was an inspiration, I guess, to
I'm
him.
I'm sure it was, yes.
And he built, I believe, the largest telescope in the world at the time?
Yes, by far the largest telescope. Prior to the Burr telescope, as we mentioned, Sir William Herschel's hit. Sir William Herschel had built, and of course, these telescopes were reflector telescopes. And of course, the importance about that is that it's the size of the mirror gives the power to the telescope.
Okay.
The reflector mirror. And Sir William Herschel's was 49 inches in diameter. And that was back in 1789, I think. And then other astronomers who had tried to build larger mirrors failed because of the problems in the metal cooling.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until 1840 that then Sir Lawrence Parsons achieved a 72-inch diameter mirror made of metal, which was bronze, silver bronze, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the key to that, of course, was conceiving the idea of an annealing oven. What do I mean by an annealing oven? But prior to the Lord Rosse, everyone, if they were making a metal mirror, they just made the metal mold and poured it into a circular mold, allowed it to cool there and then in contact with the air.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, because the outside of the metal cool being in contact with the air, and metal as it cools, it shrinks. So what would happen, cracks and gaps would form within the shrinking metal as it cooled.
And this isn't very good when you're trying to design a telescope.
No, indeed, because the whole thing would just shatter on cooling.
Yeah.
But Lord Rosse conceived the idea of an annealing oven. What he did was when he poured his 4.5 tons of silver bronze into the circular mold, he put it all back into a secondary oven, he called an annealing oven, which kept the outside molten and allow the metal to cool from the core. And that was the great key to his achievement.
So he's very much an innovator, the type of person we could do with today.
Yes, indeed.
And where did he actually make these molds?
In the castle yard.
Okay.
He built the furnaces in the castle yard and the forge and so on.
And in terms of financing the operation, was that from his own funds or...?
Well, fortunately, in the 1830s, he'd married a wealthy Yorkshire lady, Mary Fields of Heaton Fields, and she had a large estate in Yorkshire, and an income of quite a substantial income. I think it was about £20,000 a year, which in our money today would be about £2 million, I suppose. And, of course, in those old days, good old days, as I would call them, jokingly, once the wife married, her property became her husband's.
Yeah, oh, that sounds like a good deal to me. But, okay, so he had the financial backing, but he certainly wasn't somebody who was, you know, he did put the money to good use into this magnificent telescope.
Well, that was just before the Great Famine, of course. And of course, often people, when they come here, they say, and they were building the telescope during the famine and so on. They actually ceased to look to the telescope in the famine years. They spend their efforts trying to discover the cause of the potato blight.
Okay, so he wasn't oblivious to what was going on.
No, they were very. He was a very caring landowner.
And he'd be popular as a landowner, even
well,
to that
point. Well, as landowners would be popular.
Sure, of course. Now, so the size of the telescope he built then, it became the largest in the world. Try and explain to people who haven't seen it, how big is it? How impressive is it?
It weighs 12.5 tons. It's nearly 70 feet long. And the great mirror, of course, is 72 inches. That's, you see, how the reflector telescopes worked. The observer looks into through an eyepiece in the front of the telescope, looking into a small mirror called a secondary mirror. And that mirror is arranged so that it receives from a great mirror below, the great 6-foot diameter mirror. And the 6-foot diameter mirror is facing up the tube, and it's when you focus the tube on whatever object you wish to examine, the light comes down the tube and hits the great mirror, and that then is reflected into the smaller mirror.
And did they make any fantastic discoveries they started
indeed.
To use this? What would be some of the most important?
Well, prior to the Lord Rosse's telescope, astronomers had thought everything in the universe was within our galaxy, what we call the Milky Way.
Okay.
And of course, what had interested Lord Rosse was that in the earlier part of the 19th century, Sir William Herschel and Messier, a French astronomer, had mapped various areas of the sky where there appeared to be glowing light rather than individual stars. And astronomers had thought that was luminous gas scattered throughout our galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
But with Lord Rosse's great telescope, they could they could resolve out the individual stars within these distant objects.
So that was a major advance.
That was a major advance.
In a much bigger universe than we thought.
Exactly. The understanding of the universe being much vaster than they had ever imagined.
Well, John, I'd love to talk to you more, but unfortunately we're running out of time. But tell our listeners, is the Burr Castle open over the winter if they want to go visit?
Oh, yes, it's open, but we have restricted hours in the winter from 12 to 4 each day.
Okay.
And the museum is open, and the gardens.
Okay. Well, John, it's been very nice talking to you, and thanks for coming on the show.
Next up, we're looking at the very interesting life and work of John Joly from the village of Brackna, also in County Offaly. And this interview that you're going to hear is with Patrick Wise-Jackson, who's curator of the TCD Geology Museum. And TCD, of course, is where Joly spent most or nearly all of his working life.
And to tell us about Joly and his life is Patrick Wise-Jackson, who's curator of the TCD Geology Museum, who's been working for a number of years on a biography of Joly. So welcome to the program again, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
Why are you in particular so interested in Joly? You've done a lot of work on him, so obviously you find him quite an interesting character.
I certainly do. I first became interested in Joly through some of the material that we have in the Geological Museum. We have mineral collections, but we also have slides, photographic slides as well. And then I started to look at Joly. He was born in County Offaly. He was the son of a rector near Clonbillogue, born in 1857. And then shortly after his father died, he moved to Rathmines with his mother.
Okay.
And then went to Trinity.
Was he an only child?
No, he was the youngest of three boys.
Okay.
He then went to Trinity and studied civil engineering, and obviously had quite a good career, because when he graduated, the professor of civil engineering asked him to be his assistant. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of a lifelong career in the college.
Okay, so he's remembered for a lot of different things. Maybe we could stick with the geology initially. He wasn't a great man for field work, but he came up with a lot of interesting findings.
He did, yes. A lot of people think of geologists as having heavy boots and tramping the fields and mountains. Joly didn't do that. He was more an experimentalist. And amongst the things that he was really interested in and best remembered for was his work on the age of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in about 1860, 1870, people were looking at this, and Lord Kelvin, William Thomson, came up with the date of 40 million years for the age of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that intrigued Joly, and because he was interested in the sea, he looked at another method called the sodium method.
What did Kelvin look at?
Kelvin looked at the cooling rate of the Earth.
Okay, okay.
Joly, what he did, Joly assumed that originally when the oceans formed, they were fresh water. And if you could work out the rate of sodium getting into the oceans, and you could work out how much sodium there was at the present day, you could come up with an age.
Right.
And he did this, and it came out at 100 million years.
And we know, of course, today that it's what age? It's in the billions anyway.
Yes, it's 4.5 billion.
So he's a little bit out.
A little bit out, yes. But what fascinates me about Joly is not only did he use that method, but he also looked at other things. He looked at how fast sediment accumulates.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at radioactivity. And this, I think, was particularly interesting in that in 1899, I think it was, Marie Curie first recognized the element radium. And Joly looked at this and started to measure the amount of radioactive materials in a whole range of geological scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And he used things called pleochroic halos, little spheres, essentially, or dark circles in granite, to get an estimate of the age of the Earth.
And radioactivity breaks down over a while, or it changes. Isn't that really the basis of how you age a rock? You can judge...
That's right, yes. You can take something like radioactive uranium, and it breaks down at a certain rate into lead.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can measure the proportions of the radioactive material and the daughter element, the lead that's derived in a rock, you can get an age for it.
And was Joly one of the first to look at radiation in this way, to date rocks?
Yes, he was.
Okay. It's standard now today to do this, of course, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, Joly, his estimate came up at about 250 million years old for the Earth. But even that, we now know to be completely wrong. And subsequently, a young man in England called Arthur Holmes took this on board and really derived the timescales that we're now familiar with.
Right. And why was Joly out so much, do you think, at the time?
Well, he didn't recognise, first of all, that there were other features that perhaps could have affected his halos. He only looked at these Pleiocroic halos. He didn't look at various other radioactive systems.
Right. He didn't take enough into account.
No, he didn't.
And like quite a few scientists of his time, he wasn't limited to one, like a lot of scientists today, one narrow field. He was interested in many aspects.
He was, yes. And that makes him particularly interesting. He clearly had a great imagination, and that's what scientists need. They need to think, well, what am I going to look at next? What intrigues me? Mm-hmm. Two things that he was interested in was the ascent of sap. How did sap get up a 40-meter tree?
Tree sap, yes.
And this was a problem that people really hadn't worked out.
But good point. Never thought of it.
And Joly, together with a man called Henry Horatio Dixon, who became Professor of Botany in Trinity, they realized that by transpiration, by water loss on the leaves, this basically pulled the sap from the roots up to the leaves, and that water had a very strong cohesive strength, so it could be carried up through the vessels within the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing, the ascent of sap. The other thing that he looked at, and is well known for, was his color photography methods. And this he came up with in 1895, where he devised a scheme where you could basically use lantern slides, forerunners of 35 millimeter slides, and he could produce these in color.
And there was a few other things that he was well known for as well, but unfortunately we've ran out of time. I'd like to talk to you more about him. But when is your biography of Joly expected to come out, or do you have a schedule for it?
I have no schedule, and I have no publisher as yet.
Okay.
But I would imagine it should be out. I'm planning in the next 5 years.
Yeah. Well, I'll certainly be one that will read it. And thanks for coming on to briefly tell us about the life of John Joly. That's Patrick Wise Jackson at Trinity College Dublin.
Now, last in our trilogy of Offaly scientists today, we're going to talk about Charles Parsons. He made a huge impact on the world when he invented the steam turbine, and this allowed boats to move much, much faster than before. And famously, he put a turbine on his own boat, the Turbinia, at a royal viewing of boats by Queen Victoria in 1897, flew into the middle of the British Navy faster than any other boat. This created a huge stir and was a great publicity stunt, of course. And it meant that the British Navy then took notice of his invention, and they actually incorporated his steam turbine into their next generation battleships, the dreadnoughts. It also meant, of course, that it was much quicker now to travel across the Atlantic back and forth, and of course led to later tragedies like the Titanic, but it meant that America and Europe, for example, were connected much quicker than they were before. And to talk about Charles Parsons, we're going back now to John Joyce, whom we heard earlier, who's a retired scientist and a senior tour guide based at Birr Castle, which of course was the ancestral home of Charles, as well as William, his father, whom we heard about earlier. But now we're talking about Charles.
So this really was a talented family. We had another Earl on before, so there was something else.
The third Earl is the man who built the telescope, and his son, his youngest son, was Charles Parsons.
Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so we're talking about Charles Parsons. Now, what was he most famous for?
Well, I suppose Charles's most greatest achievement was the invention of the turbine engine. Prior to that, the most powerful reciprocating steam engines were only able to do about a limit of 500 revolutions per minute, where virtually overnight with the turbine it jumped to 50,000.
Okay. Now, this he was born in the middle of the 19th century, and this...
In the 1860s.
Yeah, okay. And the engine then, his engine was invented...
In 1884, he patented the turbine engine.
Okay. So before that, let's say 10 years before his invention, what was the world like in terms of transport and people getting around?
Well, very limited. The trains were just being developed and were covering the whole of the British Isles and throughout the world. And that would have been the main, and steam ships, of course, were coming into vogue. So it was all very early as far as transport was concerned, with power transport. Before that, they depended on the wind and the horses, virtually. And now, suddenly, in the 1840s, 50s and 60s, you had this massive expansion of rail and steam travel.
So it really, it'd be fair to say that his invention changed the world.
Oh, yes. Well, primarily in developing electricity. Because when I mentioned a moment ago, the maximum steam power could do about 500 revolutions because they were very, very complex engines, whereas with the turbine engine, it jumped up to 50,000 in a short time, and that was made the possibility of generating huge amounts of electricity, whereas prior to that, they couldn't do that.
Okay, and generating huge amounts of electricity could be applied in lots of different areas, of course.
Lighting towns. Yeah. Powering engines and so on.
Okay, okay. Now, Charles, tell us a little bit about Charles himself and the kind of background he was from.
Well, of course, his father being a very clever man in science and that, and they were brought up to use practical things like hammers and chisels, whereas for the landed aristocratic families, they were kind of a class apart. They had servants to do everything. But here in Burr, the Parsons family were thought to make things in the forge and so on, so they used their hands and to do practical things, which was an extraordinary, really, situation for an aristocratic family.
Sure, it would have been quite easy just to go through life doing nothing very much at all.
Servants do everything for you.
Yeah,
because they had the money.
Yeah, yeah, but they really were very, very good technically as a family.
Well, yes, and unusually for an aristocratic family, again, the boys, when they went to college, Trinity College initially, they studied engineering. Which was very unusual for the time, because normally in the aristocracy, they would go for the army, the church, or the law.
Okay, and Trinity College, of course, was the logical port of call in those days.
And of course, Trinity had an engineering school in the 1860s.
Okay, that was unusual, was it, at that time to have
the most they were far more advanced than most colleges in Great Britain.
Okay, now we were a part of the British Empire then, Ireland was the United Kingdom, but Ireland was compared favourably to Britain.
Oh, very much
in terms of engineering
very
and science.
So the higher education in Ireland tended to focus on engineering and things like that rather than the arts.
Okay, okay. Now, maybe you could just tell us in scientific terms, after he left Trinity, I mean, what happened in the lead up to this magnificent invention?
Well, following graduating from both Trinity and Cambridge College, he was apprenticed to Armstrong's, which were a great engineering firm in the industrial north of England. At that time, mainly making munitions and things like that. But Charles, in the 1870s, was working on torpedoes driven by compressed air.
Wow, yeah. So that's really something very advanced.
He then, in the 1880s, went out on his own when he developed this turbine.
Okay, so he was on his own working as a kind of an inventor of various things?
Well, only after he patented the turbine engine. Prior to that, he was a part of the Armstrong network.
Okay. Now, did it change his own life, this invention?
Well, of course it did. It made him immensely wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And he set up his engineering works in Newcastle-on-Tyne, and virtually the whole city of Newcastle-on-Tyne in the north of England grew around his engineering works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And following on from the invention, I mean, what other things did he get involved
in? Well,
the
practical thing that he had put the engine to use was in his own yacht. He had a steam yacht called the Turbinia.
Mm.
And it was in order to get the Admiralty interested in turbine-powered ships and so on at Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee in 1897 at Spithead, he came out among the anchored fleet. The Royal Navy, which was then the largest fleet in the world, was at all at anchor while the old Queen viewed them. And out among the anchored fleet came Charles, travelling at an incredible speed of 37 knots.
Okay.
Which immensely impressed the Admiralty.
Made a huge impact at the time.
Yes, and then shortly afterwards they ordered the Dreadnought, which was the first turbine-powered battleship.
Okay. The British do claim him, of course, as one of their own, but he is an Irishman.
Well, he's British, I suppose. Yeah. but they would consider themselves in those days.
He has to be up there as one of our most influential scientists.
Oh, by all means, yes.
Would you put him at the top? You're a scientist yourself.
Yes. Well, there are a number of other Irish engineers, which are quite, Lord Kelvin, for example.
Yeah.
And many others. But yes, he'd be one of the greatest.
Thanks very much, John, for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
Okay, that's John Joyce, based at Burghcastle, and he's talking to us about Charles Parsons. Now,
that's all we have time for you for this week, so thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you did, then why not check out my blog with the same name, Science Spinning, which is available on the web at seanduke.com. That's SEANDUKE.com. There you'll find podcasts of all previous Science Spinning shows going back to October 2009, and the blog is fully searchable by topic or name. Aside from the podcast, there's video and print material available there, so for anyone with an interest in science, especially what's happening in science here in Ireland, then I'd suggest, and I suppose I would, wouldn't I, that it's well worth a look. Meanwhile, I'm always delighted to hear from listeners, and if you'd like to get in touch with me to suggest a story for the show or to provide feedback, then I'd be delighted to hear from you at sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. That's sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. Until next Thursday at 3:30, when we'll again be Science Spinning, it's goodbye from me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM.